This podcast is brought to you by Lanco Group, your business partner for engineering solutions. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
Shortly, we will be joined by SBS's chief football analyst, Craig Foster, to preview the game against Jamaica, which is going to be an absolute cracker. We did hear from Ante Milicic today in the press conference. There is a little bit of team news, which we will get to, Josh, and we will also go through some of the other FIFA Women's World Cup group stage games that played overnight. Some interesting results. Some teams and countries have now exited the tournament. And then later on in the program, we will, of course, look at some of the other competitions which are in action at the moment. The Asian Champions League is still going. Isn't that just remarkable?
We tend to forget about it, Louise. Once all the Australian teams get knocked out, the A-League season finishes, but it's still cracking on. The round of 16 gets underway tonight with a couple of teams from the same countries actually facing off. But then tomorrow night, the Korean teams will be in action against Japanese and Chinese opposition. So could be very interesting to speak to Matthew Binns, columnist for K-League United, our friends over in Korea, to preview those games tomorrow night.
Looking forward to it. And then to round out the program, we'll also take a look at some of the latest transfer news and news going on in Europe, because there was one that really caught my eye overnight, and I'm sure it caught a lot of Roma fans. One of their beloved former stars has departed the club, and his role there, we will touch on that a little bit later on, though. Josh, let's go straight to some of the goals and games that happened overnight at the FIFA Women's World Cup. There were a few results, as we touch on. Unfortunately, there was a draw, Spain and China, nil all. And they both, though, have ensured that they progress to the knockout round.
In a little bit of help here, Jenny Hermoso picks out Caldenti. She was fouled. The referee has allowed the advantage. Caldenti's cross and touched on dangerously by Lucia Garcia, who gives a big thumbs up for the quality of the cross into the Chinese penalty area and so close to the opening goal of the game.
Best chance in that one, but that one finished all square. I've been pretty impressed by China at this tournament.
So you say, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't expect them to come along so quickly. I mean, the last time we saw them, well, in Australia against the Matildas, they looked quite a long way off the pace. But, you know, they've really put together a decent tournament. They pushed Germany all the way. I think should have got more out of that game. They finished third in this group, and they should finish as one of the four best third-place teams, depending on the other results. So they don't know their fate quite yet. But they should get through in one of the lower seeded spots. And I think it's been a very successful tournament for China.
Yes. And as for Spain, get a load of this. Spain have actually qualified for their first knockout round in their history. The first time ever. That is pretty remarkable, because they actually made their tournament debut back in 2015. Yeah. So recent.
It's amazing considering the success of the men's team. It was the dominant power for so long in the men's game, almost a decade, and won every tournament before them. If you look at the statistics from this game, I mean, it was pretty much one-way traffic. Spain with 24 shots to China's one, but China managed to limit the quality of those chances and, you know, and scraped out a draw. I think Spain will be a little bit disappointed to not get the win, but they still finished in second spot, so it didn't seem to, you know, it was pretty much academic for them, because they couldn't make up the ground on Germany in top spot.
No, but they did make a little bit more history as well. Spain kept their first ever clean sheet at a FIFA Women's World Cup, so that's really pleasing for them, and great to see another country taking some steps forward at the FIFA Women's World Cup. Moving on, South Africa were downed by Germany. 4-0 is how it ended on the night.
Simon's ball into the penalty area. The diving header has hit the inside of the post and is tucked away by Lina Magul for Germany's fourth. Kermini got a hand to it, but it hit the inside of the post and rebounded perfectly for Lina Magul.
With thanks to Optus Sport, of course, one-way traffic in this one. 4 goals for Germany. Alexandra Popp scoring a towering header. A few goals spread around the team from midfield as well. They didn't have Marushan in this match, the Lyon player. But, you know, they've got an impressive array of talent in the side. And I'm not entirely convinced by this Germany side, just based on that first group game against China where they were very lucky to get away with the win, trying to have 3 one-on-one chances that they just didn't convert, which has been their Achilles heel. But I think they are a little bit vulnerable, and even despite winning all 3 games, this one, you know, very comfortably. You know, I'm not entirely solid on this Germany team. They're usually a powerhouse of the women's game, but you know, I think there are some vulnerabilities in this side, and a game against South Africa, who, you know, for they've been a fun addition to the tournament, but you know, not an up there with the best quality sides. So I don't think this is really reflective of where Germany are at necessarily.
It'll be interesting to see what happens in the knockout stage, because the knockout stage is taking shape now. We know that England or Japan will take on third in Group B, E or F. France are awaiting the third place in Group C. Spain are taking on the United States or Sweden. And so it goes on. But Germany, they will face third in Group A, C or D. So that'll be telling as to who they come up against and if they can make it to a quarterfinal.
I think they probably will make it just based on the seedings. They didn't have an especially tough group this time. So I think Germany will make it to the quarterfinals. But once they come up against a really quality side who can counterattack them and actually finish off their chances, I think that might prove the end for them in this tournament. They do have individual talent across the park. Maybe it will come together, but you know, I still have my reservations.
Elsewhere, we saw that Norway reached the last 16 of the Women's World Cup and eliminated South Korea after scoring a penalty in either half in Reims.
Crowd still going, challenging the penalty area, and the referee for the second time tonight points to the spot. It's another penalty for Norway. Larsen just inside the post.
One of two penalties in that game. Carolyn Graham Hansen picking up a very heavy challenge for the second one. I'm a big fan of her. Hopefully she's okay, but you know, she's a fantastic dribbler. No arguments as to the decisions on either occasion, but I was very impressed with that South Korean goal at the end, the back heel, tidy finish.
Very
as well.
Clever, yeah, wasn't it?
Yeah, very nice bit of improvisation inside the penalty area. Nevertheless, Norway, the better team on the night.
And where are South Korea at? They leave the FIFA Women's World Cup without a point.
They do. I think they've been a little bit better than their results have suggested, although Nigeria did get the better of them and they were humbled in the first game against France. I still think they've got some catching up to do, but that third group game against Norway showed that they do have some ability in the team. And, you know, I think, you know, the future is can only be on the up for South Korea women's football.
Well, we hope so. And as we say, they've exited the tournament now. And we also saw that Nigeria and France have finished top of Group A after, again, another interesting encounter where a penalty was taken twice, one to finally get over the line.
Here's a chance. What is she going to decide? Penalty for France. This for the breakthrough for France. Oh! Our VAR are checking for another as a yellow card for the goalkeeper. Was she off her line? It's going to be taken again. She has another opportunity to break the deadlock for France. It's Renard.
Very, very lucky. 2 VAR interventions on the same penalty kick for France. As you heard there, VAR deciding the award of the penalty and then indeed intervening on the retake because the penalty was not saved. Wendy Renard hit the outside of the post, but the goalkeeper was adjudged to be slightly off her line, and so the penalty was taken again. A reprieve. Renard steps up and buries it in the top corner this time, but I thought that was very, very cruel on Nigeria. Not only did they get a red card on that, you know, just a few minutes before, but Ndidozie, the goalkeeper, I mean, she was absolutely distraught. What was it, an inch maybe, her left heel?
Yeah, or about a foot, that she was off the line. Well, unfortunately, you have to be on your line.
Under the new rules, you can have 1 foot off the line.
But she had both.
She had both feet off the line. You know, it was clear on the replay, but it was so close. And also, it didn't seem to affect the penalty in any way. I mean, it wasn't as if
she saved it.
She didn't save it. She didn't charge at the penalty taker and put her off. I guess the letter of the law, but is it in line with the spirit of the law? I'm not entirely sure. Cruel for Nigeria for certain. I think the sympathies of most neutrals will have gone to them.
Well, fortunately for Nigeria, they are still in the running to advance to the knockout stage as they are one of the best third place teams. You're listening to Evenings on FNR. Louise Taffer with Josh Parrish joining me here in the studio. And it's time to cross now to SBS's chief football analyst, Craig Foster. Craig, thank you so much for coming on the show.
That's okay, guys. Pleasure.
Craig, how have you been enjoying the tournament so far?
Yeah, look, I've been loving it. I've enjoyed seeing what you and Flair have brought to it. I think the first game against France was really great. Great stories come out and interesting lines and some predictable issues around, you know, treatment of female players, including in coverage and on social media and all these things, which I think are very important. I enjoyed the things around Sam and this whole discussion around, you know, abuse of women and girls online, which I think she importantly drew some attention to. You know, we talked about that, I think, with the I can't recall her name, to be honest, but the AFLW player who was photographed and was in the paper and then had a whole range of abuse on social media of this wonderful photo of her and the athleticism. We talked about it then, and I was sharing some work from, I think, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty around the abuse of women and girls online, which is just, you know, just absolutely horrendous. So I thought that was important. So I really like when one of these broader social issues are kind of magnified, amplified through the game when we have these major tournaments, and there's been a few, which has been good.
Craig, it's Josh here. I think it's Taylor Harris you're referring to from the AFLW. I think, you know, it's an interesting parallel you draw, and it seems as if this tournament, whether it's fair on the players or not, seems to have more at stake almost socially in their own countries. I've heard Megan Rapinoe from the US WNT come out in an interview and saying, you know, she was asked what her goal was at the World Cup, and she said, you know, to leave the, you know, the field an equal playing field or a better environment for young girls in her own country once she's finished playing. I mean, you know, that's such an incredible weight to carry.
That's very true. Look, the women's game in that respect is it's really accelerating now, which is great. But I would imagine it's probably maybe 20 years, perhaps 30, behind exactly where the men's game was. And the men have been through this exact transition. So only a couple of years ago in 2016, when I went back as the chairman of the PFA in Australia and I changed the constitution to mandate that women would have a quota on the board and the executive and brought them in inside the organisation. My message to them at that time was exactly the same. Look, we've been through this. And so now this generation have this burden. It is a burden, but it's also a responsibility they'll be very proud of later, where they have to step forward now and they have to advocate for their fellow professionals for further investment in the game and for gender equality. Is that fair? No. But, you know, what I like is you tend to see some of the leading athletes really step forward and embrace it. And it doesn't hurt their on-field performance. I mean, look at the Matildas. You know, they're advocating for fairness in prize money. And that is an incredibly important issue because it can be used then for a broader investment. And the USA have been in this space for a lot of years. It clearly hasn't. I would imagine in some respects it's brought them even closer together and it's given them a sense of purpose beyond just wearing the shirt and having a wonderful career. So it can actually be really positive.
And what did you make of, you know, Sam Kerr's recent comments and then, you know, her advocacy online?
I thought there was two aspects to it. I was kind of a bit confused. Look, I don't spend a lot of time on social media having a look, you know, what everything's being said. I was delighted that the following day she talked about the haters and the critics, and I just wonder whether they're two different issues. I was pleased that she was very forthright. I think that's who she is, and I do think that athletes have been far too sanitized, whether that's in relation to their, you know, their social work off the field or on. or whether it's around their personality. And I think there's a lot to be discussed there for football after the tournament. I just thought at the moment in relation to criticism of the team, it's not really of any great value to discuss now, but I do think there's a really good discussion there. So when it came to the haters, I was delighted that she shared that tweet afterwards. I saw what happened to Lucy in Russia. We've talked about the AFLW player. I've read the material in relation to women and girls online. And I love that Sam Kerr and the Matildas have been able to take a leading role now in amplifying this issue. And I hope that players and the PFA and perhaps the AAA, which is the players' a governing body in Australia, professional athletes, might take some leadership on that issue. I was thinking about that perhaps the PFA and FFA could have done something. I mean, the PFA got their hands full, obviously. But in future, these tournaments would actually be a wonderful opportunity to, let's say, for instance, that the PFA were to monitor all of the social media accounts of the 23 players who were there and, you know, create some type of log or some type of research into the abuse that they actually do receive. I think that could be really valuable because it's at these times, and we saw with Lucy last year, when they're in the public eye and very prominent is when they tend to be attacked. So in that way, sport can, you know, the Matildas can use these moments to educate and to help others. So I was pleased about that. When it came to Sam's, you know, commentary about, in inverted commas, critics, I'm not quite sure what she was referring to. I did hear, for instance, former players like Heather Garriock have strong opinions around, you know, the tactical setup of the team, and I thought they were both valid and very important. I think that all of those former players have an obligation, responsibility to do that. And I'm questioning, and I've kind of got my eye on for a discussion later around what the environment is around the team, because we saw a little bit of that in recent years with the Socceroos as well. And I think they need to realise that it's not their team. It's wonderful playing for the country, but it's actually the nation's team. And put it this way, a lot of people were talking about the defensive principles, and we spent a lot of time, you know, trying to, if you like, educate or encourage all of Australia to talk about these things and understand it to a high level. And then if the players come out and say, well, you know, all the critics talking about all the defending, it kind of defeats the purpose of creating a literate football country, right? Mm. However, having said all that, I just think it's a discussion for down the track. I don't think the players have their head in that space. And I think it's more a matter of FFA, the environment they put around the players and you know, the culture that you have within your national team unit and FFA, which I think is very much anti-critical, anti-criticism anyway. And finally, guys, I might just say this. The thing about that is, why I support your programs and all the others and try and give as much time as possible. If you look in recent years, you know, we've got some significant challenges in the game, whether it's crowds or TV, whatever the case is. And in fact, the actual quantum of media coverage that we have of the game, I would suggest, has gone down a bit. And one of the reasons is because critical views have been frowned upon. And in fact, through the Lowy FFA era, they cracked down on it very heavily, including with News Limited outlets and Fox and others. So in actual fact, you know, the journalists aren't there just to write positive things. Journalists aren't cheerleaders. And I heard Elise Kellen, and I think it's actually damaging our game. We've actually got less coverage now. Elise Kellen Knight spoke beautifully on it, I thought, but she said, look, you know, people have a right to have their views, and of course we haven't really been defending well and all these things is great. But then she did say, but look, I think we've won back a lot of support, and if I was to say something to Elise or to the team, I would say, no, don't conflate critical views of the way you play or the tactics with support. They're different. People always support you. You're the most loved national team we have. But that doesn't mean that people can't take a view of the way that your defensive principles are or are not working. So, you know, that's kind of where I think players can go down the wrong avenue, and that's a matter of leadership around the team, in my view, which I think is pretty clearly lacking inside FFA for quite a long time.
Craig, I think you've hit on a number of things there. Yeah, I think it's dangerous to, as you say, equivocate the, you know, online abuse to criticism of the team to not supporting the team, sort of almost three different things. And
That's right.
I mean, it's almost a fact, a function of how passionate people are about the Matildas now, that is the why they have all these opinions. Why are they, engaging in this debate, whether it's in an SBS studio or on Twitter?
Yeah, that's right. And look, these discussion's a really, really important one. So, I thank Sam for making it happen. Now, the thing is, in that moment, of course, they've had all of these things online. I do think it was a unique circumstance because she had the Stajic issue and, all of those issues coming out, and there was a lot of vitriol. So I could understand why she would be upset anyway. And equally in that moment, she just makes a statement and here we are still talking about it. But it's important for that reason. And what I've said since is, look, that's wonderful that she did so. Great. She has every right to do that. However, I think the team needs to have a little bit more sophisticated view. I don't expect the players to get that themselves. I think you have to have people around it who should make that happen. But equally, I've been at pains to say the Matildas also need to realise that expectations have risen, and as their performances rise, as they have a larger, broader fan base, and as more of Australia come to be, have a deep interest in their female national team, you have to expect that that's going to happen. The expectations are higher. So I think there's some adjustment perhaps on both sides. But ultimately, aside from, this concept of abuse and this heinous sexual abuse and homophobia and all this disgusting stuff, the actual analysis of the game is both positive and negative. But that doesn't mean people's support ever wavers. I don't believe it does. So, yeah, it's a really important issue for the game that I think FFA need to get hold of. And because they've been very sensitive to criticism for a very long time, my concern is that that's filtered through to our national teams, and it shouldn't. I'd like to see some good leadership in there inside FFA saying, guys, it's got actually nothing to do with you. We want Australia having a whole broad range of opinions. Yallop yesterday said perfectly. She said, looks absolutely great as long as it's not personal. And I think that's right. Like when Robbie Cruz stuff in Russia went to the family, when it goes down that disgusting area, all you have to do is, that's when the whole game should come out. So, no, that's totally unacceptable. But we want everyone discussing all of these. I actually thought the discussion around the defensive principles and the line and offside trap and all those things was absolutely brilliant for the game.
And Craig, one other thing before we move on to talking about the upcoming game against Jamaica. Do you think that the Women's World Cup is also reflective of the disparity between countries? Like, for example, with the USA defeating Thailand 13-0 and maybe where Thailand are at?
Oh, it undoubtedly is. And the broader issue is really this. What are the expectations of the female players around the world of the rights that they have under FIFA to investment in the game? Okay, so we saw the disparity is in large part due to the disparity investment in both countries. Okay, and of course, US has their college system, and they've been going a very long time. There's many countries in the world where the investment is very low, where the professional game is struggling for resources and for capital and so on. And what you've got is a national team of Australia feeling that the only way to make a difference in terms of the broader investment is that they have to take a stand themselves, which should never be the case. So the broader question is, who is supposed to be advocating for female football globally? Who is responsible for that? I don't think there is anyone. We have PFA are a member of FIFPro's international, is the global players body, but the US national team, the most powerful team in the world, are not members. They have their own union in US, and therefore FIFPro don't bargain for them. They don't represent them. The Australians now have said to FIFPro essentially, look, we feel as though we need to do it ourselves. So I think FIFPro have got serious question marks around their level of advocacy of women's football. I think that's being questioned by women around the world, I think rightly. So to me, I think the women have to have a really good look at it and say, okay, what do countries like Thailand need here? It's a wonderful story that Bob Marley's daughter, Sadella, has funded the team. But, we've seen that with Matildas for decades. I mean, in 2015, they had to have a strike in order to just get some type of decent conditions here. So therefore, it's the Australians who are in the position saying, we're not prepared to do that anymore. We're going to assert our rights. And I'm looking at this World Cup, this broader discussion is, okay, what should FIFA be doing for women's football globally? Because at the moment, it's completely arbitrary. What they did is they said, well, we think it's a good idea to uplift male prize money by 42 million or 48, whatever it was, and the women by 15, despite the fact that they've got a statutory responsibility to gender equality, right? Non-discrimination. So therefore, I think that Ada Hegerberg, who's a very strong personality, I think Amandine Henri, I think Megan Rapinoe and Carly Lloyd, these legends, I think Sam Kerr and Elise, I think they should be getting together and saying, okay, what are we entitled to as a women, as a female and girls game globally, and how are we going to assert those rights? Because at the moment, that discussion is not happening, and they're reliant on FIFA coming up with new conditions. And all FIFA says, oh, of course, we're going to have a discussion in 3 months. We sign an MOU with UN Women, and they'll come out and say, oh, okay, well, here's another bit of this and bit of that. That can't happen. I think that you need to have this really broad discussion now and say, okay, well, what are we entitled to as a women's game? You know, what is the percentage of the global game should be attributed to us right now? And on that basis, where's it going to go? How are we going to implement that? And what do all of our competitions look like? I think it's a really interesting time. And by the way, who's going to advocate for that for us? And how's that going to be run? And in many other sports, there's been many different models as to how women's sports been run. And I think all those models are open. I don't take it as read that Gianni Infantino has any commitment whatsoever. And nor Fatma Samoura, by the way, who I've met there and dealt with recently on the Hakim case, and I think is a very nice lady, but she is politically minded. She operates within an Infantino paradigm, which means no one is going to advocate properly for women around the world right now unless they do it themselves.
Completely agree, Craig. I think relying on FIFA to instigate change is, you know, never going to lead you anywhere fast, but narrowing our focus to the game tomorrow morning against Jamaica. Again, injury problems in the side. Claire Polkinghorne's out again. Tamika Yalof has been ruled out of a starting role. What do you think, you know, the selection will look like? And what have you made of the choices that you know, Ante Milicic has been sort of forced into with all the unavailabilities?
Well, I thought he did well in the last game. I mean, he was under a lot of pressure, right? And that'll be good for him. He's still a young coach. It's because his first World Cup, his first major, head role, aside from the under 20 males. So it was immense pressure for him. And then what happened is Claire got injured. He had to reshuffle the back line, and his back line hadn't been working well at all. And they were struggling with the principles that he was trying to put into place, which I think in hindsight, there wasn't really enough time for him to do so. I think he realised that. He changed them for the last game. In some ways, having a couple of different players in that back line, you know, having to bring Steph inside to the number four position might have helped him in that respect, because he was able to say to them, look, guys, we've got only, you know, half of our back four is different. We're not going to be able to apply what we've been practicing since Turkey. So let's just go back to, you know, what's reasonably normal. So I think it kind of worked in his favour, but he stood up under the pressure really well. He didn't panic at 2-0 down. I saw him pulling Chloe Legazzo, talking about a couple of things that he saw. I think it was about the run in behind the line. So I was really pleased for him, because I thought it was a big moment. It could have gone very bad for him, and that can be bad for a coaching career. And so I was delighted for him and the team. For this one, I don't think it's bad that there are more injuries, including to Tamika. I think she's been one of our really key players, has done a great job. But you want to have the confidence to be making some changes in this game and resting people anyway. For the you should be winning it. I reviewed the last two games of Jamaica yesterday, and it's difficult to see them creating too much. You should be able to create reasonably easily to be, you know, and at number five, number six in the world, you should be winning this game, even with 3, 4, 5 changes in the lineup. And therefore, I think that's probably positive. I will give Steph another game in there at number four. It might give them an opportunity to play someone else left back rather than KK, and perhaps KK inside in number six. I certainly hope so anyway, because I do believe when we hit big teams in the knockout stage, perhaps quarterfinal, she's going to be needed there. I don't think the midfield operates anywhere near as well without KK in that position. So it should all be positive, and you know they just need to put on a really execute. It's well timed actually, because they kind of had a, you know, ordinary against Italy with some real worries because the defence was affecting the overall confidence and cohesion, I think. And then, not the players, I'm talking about the way of defending. The second game was wonderful, but still a few concerns. This should be really, I think, a confidence builder. You know, just execute really well, get a good win and moving on with great confidence. And by that time, Italy's completely forgotten. And then you're in the round of 16 and let's go, you know, giddy up. That's where Australia wants to be.
And Craig, you touch on some of the concerns. What do you think the Matildas might need to tweak and work on before they head into the knockout stage where, you know, they could come up against the likes of the host nation, France?
Yeah, that's going to be, they're going to be really big tests. You know, I don't think as yet we're playing, you know, let's hope we're going to do what is a traditional team that goes all the way through the tournament, as you know, to semi-final or beyond, who tend to improve throughout. I think, you know, we're relying a lot on balls from wide areas at the moment, and we're not being able to really play through the middle. We don't have a lot of split passes or through passes, these types of things that you'd like to see with that bit of variation. I wonder whether he might play Katrina Gorry against Jamaica. It just depends whether he thinks he might need her later in the tournament. But I think you probably want to give more midfielders, you know, some time just in case you get one or two more injuries anyway. The reason I say that is they play a 4-foot-2, and so, you know, that third player or that number 10 against Jamaica can just cause havoc. That's basically what Italy did. And they, you know, when you play only two players in the centre of midfield, and against strong fullbacks that Australia has, means they're wide and their fielders can't come too far inside. It means you should be able to just pull them to pieces. And so I think it's going to be a much different game in terms of possession and Australia's ability to pull them around the park and so on. But it's that creative aspect that is a little bit of a worry at the moment because, you know, look at the goals we scored the other night and what did we create aside from that? Well, we had a great header from Chloe Lagazzo, who's done great getting in the box in those positions. But aside from that, you know, not as much as we'd like.
Craig, you said the magic word, I think. Katrina Gorry, I thought I was alone on Katrina Gorry Island, just me and Ante Jukic, but I really hope she gets a run in this game. I think we've actually just lost Craig Foster, but, you know, it's been an absolute pleasure having him on the show. He's just the most insightful guy on so
very
many levels, tactically,
with his time.
And, you know, and also just talking about the player rights and so forth. You know, I think it's a huge issue and something confronting the game. Yes, I think we've just got Craig Foster back. You know, just lost you for a second, Craig, but thank you so much for joining us. I hope Katrina Gorry gets a run in this game because I think she's a different kind of midfielder that we haven't really been giving an opportunity to in most of our national sides.
Yeah, so I thought John Aloisi said it correctly the other day when he, you know, did a bit of analysis on Optus, where he said, look, you know, our team has been really set up to go really quickly on transitions, and that means Caitlin Ford in that number 10 position as well, of course. A lot of speed, getting behind quickly, but of course teams have taken that away from us. Yeah. And that's one reason why we're able to get the ball wide, but we're just getting a lot of crosses in, you know, and trying to make something happen in that way. Whereas Katrina Gorry is that player who can get in between those areas and perhaps find passes that we're not so used to. And I do think that against the better teams, it's likely that we're going to need that. Even if she was to come off the bench, you know, let's say, for instance, that you're planning that you might have to play against a France or someone strong quarterfinal or something. Then, you know, in the second half, might you need someone who's able to, you know, find those little passes? I think it's highly likely. And so there's no doubt now with Jamaica being the third game, you know, I think Ante's got to be, no question, he will be just projecting a little bit further ahead. And hopefully the team that we see starting tomorrow should give us a very good sense of which players he thinks might have to play a role against stronger teams, you know, in the course of the next couple of weeks.
Well, Craig, you've been very generous with your time. And as I mentioned to you, I love your analysis because you're so insightful and you are really playing an important role in educating the country on, you know, many of the football terms and how the game is played. So thank you again for coming on Evenings on FNR. And we look forward to watching you throughout the remainder of the Women's World Cup.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Well, my pleasure. Let everyone tune in tomorrow and let's see how the Matildas go. Eh? Let's hope for a great one.
Go Matildas. Craig Foster, SBS Chief Football Analyst, joining us on Evenings on FNR. Remember, you can catch all of the Matildas games live and free and in HD on SBS. And, you know, they'll be obviously showing the game tomorrow morning against Jamaica. It's still a must win, but I think Foz is right on the money when he says, you know, you have to look at some of the other options. You have to look at making a couple of changes to keep players fresh and to try new things as well, because I think the team, you know, it's still lacking a little bit of that subtlety, and, you know, that's why I'm banging on about Katrina Gorry getting a run.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that we can see some changes and a bit of squad rotation from this Matildas team and from Ante Milicic. I'm also hearing teen sensation Mary Fowler, the 16-year-old, will come into the game and could make an appearance off the bench, which is what we would love to see. I think she'll become the fourth or fifth youngest in Women's World Cup history to start or come off as a substitute. Anyway, Josh, we might take a quick break, but there's still plenty more to come.
Yes, we'll be chatting to Matthew Binns from K-League United after this very short break.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
Welcome back to Evenings here on FNR Football Nation Radio, your voice of football in Australia and across the world, including Asia, which is where we're heading to next. The Asian Champions League continues tonight and tomorrow night, the round of 16 in action. And to take us through a couple of those games is a columnist for K-League United, our friends over in South Korea, Matthew Binns, who joins us now. Matthew, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. The games we're discussing in particular, tomorrow night's fixtures, Ural Reds taking on Ulsan Hyundai and Shanghai SIPG taking on Jeonbuk. Those two, Jeonbuk and Ulsan, the top two in the K-League at the moment, which, you know, isn't always the case. It isn't always the case that the sides that are still in the Champions League, you know, can maintain their success from the previous year's qualification and also domestically once you actually get around to the crunch matches next time.
Especially Ulsan in this case. Ulsan are notorious for not being able to balance domestic commitments and the Champions League. But this year they've strengthened well in the off-season and they're holding their own. They're second only on goals scored. It's one of the K-League's fewer flaws, if you prefer, that they use goals scored instead of goal difference. And Ulsan, yeah, they're doing very well. They've really strengthened the spine this time. They've increased their depth. They've got some good backups in over the winter, and it's working out for them.
Jeonbuk in particular, you know, excite me. They seem to have a lot of attacking players at their disposal, but you know, how many of those players are actually in their squad for the Champions League? Because I know the foreign player restrictions will make it a little bit tougher for them.
Jeonbuk's squad, there tend to be a lot of rotation, especially recently. The last game saw quite a lot of players rested ahead of this match. Jeonbuk are still managing to perform well, though, on the domestic front. Their key players, though, will likely all be playing. Their foreign players will only probably be Ricardo Lopez. I know they do have Bernie Ibini, but he has been coming back from injury since the beginning of the season. I don't know whether he'll be quite fit for this midweek fixture. They also have Adriano, who was the top scorer in the competition a few seasons ago, but sadly he's out for the season. So despite having some strong foreign talent, they will only be playing one of their foreign players, I think, in this match.
So does that mean with the injury problems that Kim Shin-wook, the giant Korean target man, might be given a run in this game?
I'd hope so, and I wouldn't usually say that because he is both a man that he infuriates me, but he also amazes me as well at times. He's a bit of an enigma. But I think in this game, he's perfectly suited for it. Now, Jeonbuk only seems to have two fit strikes at the moment. They've got Lee Dong-guk, who is the 40-year-old veteran who still performs season upon season and performs miracles. But Kim Shin-wook seems better suited at the moment for this particular game. There's a number of reasons for that. I think the first and foremost, Kim Chinook is in good domestic form this season. He's scored 8 goals. He's got 3 assists. He's also not doing too bad in this competition with 3 goals and an assist. But also, Shanghai have got quite poor stats when it comes to aerial duels. And I think that just screams, bring on a towering striker and see what havoc he can cause in that penalty area.
It was a theme at the last World Cup in Russia with Kim Shin-wook starting up front for South Korea. They tended to play football that was totally unsuited to him and try and play on the counter-attack, and then they'd substitute him off and then proceed to lump long balls into the penalty area, which, I mean, it just it was bizarre. But, you know, he seems to be a bit of a polarising figure.
Yeah, definitely. It doesn't help as well that last year he was the most expensive paid player in the K-League, which when you judge it with the goals he scores, it doesn't really add up of what you're really getting for your money. But he fits into the Jeonbuk system quite well. He's not paid to score as much, but more assist and bring other players into play. Jeonbuk have a very strong midfield, and they'll be boasting another strong midfield on Wednesday night with Lopez, Moon Sung-min, who was last year's top Korean scorer in the K-League. They've got Lee Sung-gi, who has 4 assists in this competition and looks quite good this year. And they've also got Son Jun-ho, who a couple of seasons ago, he was the top assist maker in the league. So it's more about bringing players into play rather than relying on him to get the goals.
And coming up against Shanghai SIPG, obviously we all know about Hulk and Oscar and the threat that they pose, but it's one thing identifying it and another thing stopping it. Do you see their defence holding up, especially away from home?
Well, Jeonbuk's defence is mostly made up of Korean internationals. If you go across the back, you've got Kim Jin-soo on the left. He's got experience at Hoffenheim in the Bundesliga, and he's still South Korea's first-choice left-back. On the right-back, they've got Korea's first-choice as well, which is Lee Yong, and they're both expected to start. Kim Jin-soo was suspended at the weekend, so he's fresh, and Lee Yong was rested as well. In the centre, they've got Hong Dong-ho, who is a former Korean international, and they've got another player called Kim Min-hyuk, who was one of those players that was always on the fringe of getting a call-up, but he never quite made it. It's a very strong defence. It's taken a while for them to get used to each other this season, because last year they had Kim Min-jae, who was a standout player, and he's become a star on the international stage. But Kim Min-jae moved to Beijing Guoan in the winter, and Kim Min-hyuk's taken a while to fit in, but slowly but surely this defence is looking more and more assured with each passing week.
Well, moving our attention to Ulsan, Mix Diskerud is the man that most people have their eye on. The American international seems to have been in pretty fine form this season.
Yeah, he arrived last season in the summer on loan from Manchester City, but I wouldn't be surprised if your listeners haven't heard of him in that sense. He never made an appearance for the Premier League champions. But he's been a very, very good player this year. He's had some eye-catching moves and off-the-ball movement. But he's also quite good at scoring as well. He's bagged a few goals this season. And, yeah, he's looked really good. And he's possibly going to be leaving in the summer. Ulsan fans are begging him to stay, holding up banners at the end of matches in recent weeks, just wanting to extend his loan at the club.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's been such a positive acquisition for them. I did see a bit of Ulsan in the when they play against, I think it was Sydney SC earlier on in the season. It seemed the defence was quite solid, but they seemed to struggle a little bit to score in Asia. They seemed to find their scoring boots, you know, as the group stage went along. Do you think, you know, they'll be, you know, planning on attacking Urawa or letting Urawa come to them?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Ulsan actually haven't won in their last 7 away games in the Asian Champions League. But that doesn't mean they haven't been losing either. They've managed to draw 5 of those. And their manager, Kim Do-hun, he's got a bit of a reputation for playing negative football when the occasion demands it. Mm. I think we can expect them to be sitting back and look to pick off Urawa on the counter, which would kind of fit into their style of play anyway. They are quite a counter-attacking team. They're also quite strong at home. They've won all 3 games at home without conceding in this competition, and I'd imagine they'd like to just make sure the second leg is alive and try to win it there.
Well, both teams playing away from home, I guess a draw would be a good result. Could I get a prediction for you, from you for each game before we let you go, Matthew?
I'll say 1-1 for both games. I think neither team will go all out because they both know that in Jeonju and in Ulsan respectively, they are far stronger than they are on the road.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for joining us on Evenings on FNR. Those games kicking off at 8:30. That's Urara Ulsan tomorrow night, Australian Eastern Standard Time, and 10 p.m. for Shanghai SIPG versus John Book with the return legs the following week. And for more information, you can go on over to kleagueunited.com. We're also going to be replaying one of the podcasts, the preview podcast for these ACL games and the K-League marquee matches, which will be replayed just after the show finishes in about 10 minutes. So stick around on FNR Football Nation Radio for that. But Matthew Binns, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
No worries at all. That was K-League United columnist Matthew Binns with a little bit of an Asian Champions League preview. There's also games tonight between Kashima Antlers and Sanfrecce, as well as Guangzhou Evergrande versus Shandong Luang. So the Asian football continues, even if Australian clubs aren't a part of it anymore, Louise.
Yes, action aplenty at the moment all around the world. Josh, we might take a quick break and then dive into the rest of the European news when we come back.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
Evenings on FNR, Louise Taffer with Josh Parrish here in the studio with me. Josh, let's take a look at some of the latest news in Europe. There is a little bit going around. One that actually isn't in Europe, but I'm still going to say it because it's related to the A-League. Did you hear that the former Wellington star Roy Krishna has signed a one-year deal with an Indian Super League outfit?
Yes, ATK. It was an open secret that he was off on his way. I think Jason Pine's been tweeting about it for about a month now. I think this is a bit of a bad look for the A-League because it's the Johnny Warren medalist departing for a league that most A-League fans would consider inferior, even if the wages are pretty healthy over there in the Indian Super League. Obviously, it's his prerogative and, you know, he's obviously been offered a great deal there. He's 32, you know, he's a player who relies on speed. Maybe some of the A-League clubs didn't feel, you know, it was worth investing in him at this point in time, because I think if he's, you know, for example, offered anywhere near the deal that Costa Barbarossa has just signed at Sydney FC, he stays in the A-League. But, you know, well done to Roy Krishna because he's worked hard for a long time and he's earned this for him and his family.
That's it. And I think that he actually rejected several offers from other clubs across Asia. I'm not quite sure about how many clubs in Australia actually made a bid for him. I definitely know that Wellington were doing everything in their power to keep a hold of him.
Yeah, absolutely. I just couldn't, I guess, afford it. They couldn't afford to compete with some of those offers. I know there was some interest from South Korea as well, which would have been interesting to see him go over there. But, you know, obviously he's decided this move is the best. I think it's only a one-year contract.
Yeah.
So, you know, who knows? He might decide it's not worth it over there and come back to the A-League in a year's time. But, you know, good luck to him, I say.
Moving on to one of the other stories, James Rodriguez has agreed to join Napoli, and the Italians actually want a loan plus option to buy before closing in on the deal with Real Madrid.
Real Madrid can't seem to get rid of this guy permanently. I mean, it's just loan deal after Bayern. Was it a two-year loan at Bayern he had? It was something
strange like that.
So he's just sort of running down his contract at different locations. This, however, is a sensational pickup for Napoli. I think he'll be really good there. They were looking for someone in that goal-scoring mode, attacking midfield. He's a different player to Mario Kamsic, very different style, but I think he will operate in a similar role in their team with, you know, the creativity that he provides. I wonder if they're going to adjust the formation because they usually play 4-3-3 with just sort of two eights. They don't really play with a number 10, but James Rodriguez really needs to play as a number 10 to be really effective. At Bayern, you know, they could shift him around a little bit because Bayern are so dominant in the Bundesliga that, you know, you can play him as an 8 or a 6 in some Bundesliga games, not all. But I think in Serie A, he's going to have to be playing as a number 10. I think he'll do well there, and I think Napoli will sort of mould the team around him.
Very good pickup once it goes through. But questions around Real Madrid, what are they going to do with their squad? How are they going to balance financial fair play? Zinedine Zidane has a lot on his hands over the next coming weeks, but I'm hearing that after reports surfaced yesterday saying that Bayern Munich had put in a bid for Gareth Bale, The agent of Gareth Bale has actually come out today and said that no offer has been made. So what is going on with Gareth Bale and where is he going to go? Will any club in the world pick him up? Surely.
Well, I think I can only think of two realistic destinations. And
are you going to say Tottenham Hotspur?
And?
Manchester United?
Correct. Hold on. I don't think, you know, he's such damaged goods at this point. He's on so much money at Real Madrid. They can't find anybody to pay his wages. If they had a suitable club, you know, I don't think they'd even demand much of a transfer fee. He'd be off on his way. They may have to cop it and end up paying part of his wages for the duration of his Real Madrid contract when he signs at another club. Sometimes that happens. But Gareth Bale, his injury problems, lack of motivation, it seems. He's lost a lot of confidence. He still seems to play reasonably well for Wales. So, you know, there's still a player there. But, you know, he seems to spend more time on the golf course than he does on the pitch sometimes.
Which is unfortunate because we know he wants to actually play, but yeah, he hasn't been able to break into the Real Madrid squad over the past couple of months.
That bothered anymore. He doesn't seem to have the drive that he used to. Manchester United will certainly be interested, but I don't think they'll want to pay what he's on at Real Madrid. Maybe he might be involved as a make-weight for Paul Pogba. Who knows?
Well, potentially they could do a swap. Again, it comes back to the question, how is Zidane going to manage financial fair play? Because they've just signed five or six players so far and they're on pretty big contracts. They're going to have to make way and some of these players are going to have to be out the door.
Well, they're going to have to. I mean, obviously FFP is over periods of 3 years, I think, rather than just the one season. You don't have to match up the accounts. So they might have to work out some creative accounting down the line to make the books balance. But speaking of Paul Pogba, I mean, he's just come out and said in no uncertain terms that he wants a new challenge and he wants to leave Manchester United, surprising absolutely nobody. And I think Real Madrid is the only realistic destination for him at this point. I can't see him going anywhere else.
Has he said the famous words that I would love a transfer to Real Madrid? Because we know that Perez really, really loves when players actually come out and say that it is their dream to go to Real Madrid.
He needs players to buy into the mythos of the club, doesn't he?
They have to say the magic, like, words, the magic sentence, and then it's like, poof.
I mean, Zidane's there. I think, you know, he would have been a hero of Pogba's when he was growing up.
And you'd have to say that being a Frenchman, Zidane would love to bring many of those World Cup stars to his team, which is why the likes of Mbappe, Pogba, the list goes on. They've all been linked there.
And Real Madrid will always be linked with these players. I think Pogba's, you know, said in the past that he would love to play for Madrid. I don't think he said it this summer, but it's pretty obvious that he wants out. And, you know, why would he want to stay at Manchester United after the way he, you know, his career has taken a downturn? If it wasn't for that World Cup win, this would have been an entirely barren spell for him in terms of, you know, winning major trophies. So you saw about 6 weeks of fantastic Paul Pogba form when Solskjaer first took over and then it dipped again. I don't think he wants to stick around because I don't think he feels he's valued or respected at Manchester United, and the team certainly isn't performing. So why would he want to stay?
I don't think his creativity is being used to its maximum potential at Manchester United. We've been saying that for many years now.
I mean, Manchester United have been a dysfunctional club for some seasons now. So, you know, it's not really Pogba's fault, even though I think, you know, a lot of pundits and some of the supporters even seem to be laying the blame at his feet. It's not his fault, but he also is a very particular player to accommodate in terms of the role he plays. So, you know, he's not the easiest player to fit into your side. You almost need to put him in the perfect spot for him to be effective.
One other one before we go on to the final story. PSG have actually made contact for Philippe Coutinho as he nears an exit of Barcelona. And we talk about players who potentially haven't managed to kind of fit in with their squads. I don't think Coutinho has managed to really fit in at Barcelona for whatever reason, but he looks to be on his way out. Is PSG the destination?
I think it could be. I think he needs to get out of there because Barcelona, they don't value him there at all. I can't imagine, you know, a transfer of a high-profile player going worse. I mean, he leaves Liverpool, they win the Champions League, and, you know, he's on the losing side of that comeback. And the Barcelona fans don't like him. I don't think he's settled into the squad, just even socially. And I don't think it's set up around him to, you know, enable him to be a success because he's not an athletic player. He's a technical player. And they don't play a number 10, Barca. They don't they try and fit him on the left-hand side of that front three because I think he's too flaky to play as an Iniesta replacement, which is what they initially bought him to be, which is crazy. But he doesn't complement the rest of the front three because Suarez, you know, he's still got a lot of quality, but he's lost a lot of several yards of pace, I would say. Messi doesn't, you know, do the hard yards in terms of running. So they naturally look better with Ousmane Dembele on the left side of the front three when he can run beyond and be that energetic, pacey player. Whereas Coutinho, you know, he's just more of the same. And I don't think that complements what Barcelona already have at their disposal.
Unfortunately, because Coutinho is an amazing player. He's got a lot of quality and technical ability, as you touch on. So hopefully he can get back on track and get regular, you know, minutes week in, week out.
Yeah, I don't think it's just regular minutes either. It's a coach that knows how to use him and a team that's, you know, complements his attributes.
And I don't know if PSG is a team that really complements Philippe Coutinho.
Well, I don't know where he plays in that side. I mean, Neymar obviously is injured at the moment, but
reports are coming out of PSG that they are looking to sell him, but guess what? They're not willing to accept anything less than the world record, which is $364 million.
Yes, that's famous Neymar transfer. I can't see him leaving PSG because what club is going to pay that fee for him, especially when he's had so many injury problems
and
some off-field controversy as well surrounding him. You know, his career is again taking a nosedive. These three players we're talking about, Coutinho, Pogba, Neymar, probably three of the biggest stars in world football over the past few years that, you know, haven't lived up to their potential. And Neymar, this PSG transfer has been a disaster for him personally. I mean, imagine if he was still at Barcelona, they probably would have won another Champions League.
Yeah. Oh, that front three at Barcelona in their heyday was just amazing to watch. Messi, Suarez and Neymar, just
MSN.
Amazing.
I mean, I think ego was probably his downfall in the end because he felt like he was the third banana.
He was in Messi's shadow.
Always in Messi's shadow.
I didn't see it
like that.
Wanted
to win a Ballon d'Or. Well, he obviously did. And, you know, it's, I think, speaks to his immaturity as a player and as a person.
And the last one before we go, unfortunately, we've seen the former Roma captain Francesco Totti leave his position within the club's managerial department yesterday after the American owner James Pelotta has basically given him no respect over the past couple of years.
I'm sure the Roma fans will react in a completely calm and reasoned manner to this news. No, I think there'll be riots in the streets, honestly.
Seriously. Totti has actually come out, and if you look and listen at some of these quotes that he said he never had the chance to express himself. They never involved me. He added that for 8 years here, since the Americans came, they've done everything they could to sweep us aside. And basically, he said that this is far worse than retiring as a player. Leaving Roma is like dying. I feel like it'd be better if I died. Those quotes coming from Francesco Totti after he leaves Roma after 30 years.
Very dramatic stuff. And I think this will set off a firestorm of criticism among the ultras. It's going to be a messy summer for Roma, it looks like.
Yes, indeed. And we'll keep you updated with it all at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for your company.